Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. This show offers an intellectual discussion on technologically enabled disruption, because investing in innovation starts with understanding it. To learn more, visit arc-invest.com.
ARK Invest is a registered investment advisor focused on investing in disruptive innovation. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK or podcast guests and are not endorsements or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Clients of ARK Investment Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Hello, I'm Nemo, a multi-omic analyst at ARK Invest. Welcome back to our FYI or For Your Innovation podcast. Today, I'm joined with Professor George Church, who is a well-known American geneticist, molecular engineer, and chemist and entrepreneur. Professor Church is the professor at Harvard Medical School. He's a professor of health and science and technology at Harvard University and MIT, and a founding member of the Wyss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering at Harvard. Professor Church has many, many publications and many, many patents, and he's a founder of many companies in the biospace. Welcome, Professor Church. So at the moment, short-read sequencing is dominating the sequencing space. How do you think the sequencing space will evolve in the terms of the short versus the long-read sequencing?
Short reads are quite useful for tagging things, barcode tagging. They're good for in situ, where you're seeing where things are in living cells and in fixed tissue. I think the long reads also, they tend to come from platforms that are very low entry costs. So in other words, you can get a nanopore sequencer up and running, for $1,000, and each run, you can start getting information within an hour of getting the sample. So this is very low barrier to entry. It still is slightly more expensive, but I think that price is going to come down. With new AI machine learning algorithms, it's getting more accurate. I think it definitely doesn't have the accuracy problem. The long reads have eliminated the accuracy problem of putting reads in the wrong place and getting scrambling and so forth. So now it's just a matter of improving the accuracy of, on the individual base pair level.
Do you think that we will end up using both forms, or will be like a one winner? And when I say the both forms, do you think we'll be using kind of both short and long read, but for the different applications?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a need for short and long applications, maybe sometimes even for the using them both side by side for a particular application, like sequencing human genomes for genetic counseling. I think there are some things like repeats that can be quite pathological, and therefore you need to accurately determine them, and that requires long read.
When it comes to genomics data, there are many concerns about the data privacy and the patient data, and how can patient data can be actually protected. What do you think about the use of blockchain technology for data storage and sharing? And in general, how do you think about convergence of the genomics and the blockchain technologies?
Well, I think there's going to be a broad range of people, from those who put their genome in the public domain, as many of the people as I have and many people in my project. We've also tried to provide the people that have the most concern about privacy with technologies like homomorphic encryption queries and recorded, and those queries are recorded in a blockchain public ledger. So you know who asked what queries, and you keep the queries limited. But it is possible to ask things of an encrypted genome without decrypting it. So that means that when your genome is decrypted, it is in principle at risk. Someone could go in and lift it at that moment if they can get access. But if you never decrypt it and use algorithms that don't require decryption, then you're a bit safer. People should be aware also that your DNA can be read by anybody, if you're walking around leaving your DNA on surfaces, on dinnerware and cups and so forth. So, but I think we're entering a realm where if you want to be very careful about it's not like it's really that dangerous, but still people should be able to get whatever they want. If they want to have security, I think we have the technology to provide it.
Do you think that blockchain could be a good medium for the storage of the patient genomic data?
I think blockchain is a good way of storing the record of in a way that can't be forged, of what's been done, what's been sequenced, who's been asking questions of it, and even the sequence itself in principle. There are plenty of ways of encrypting genomes. The thing that's tricky in storing them, the thing that's tricky is how do you ask questions of the genome without putting it temporarily at risk? A third party can ask a question without having to receive an unencrypted form of the genome. And I think that's totally feasible now. Very few groups are using it yet, but I think it is definitely feasible.
And what do you think about DNA as a storage vehicle of the biological data in general?
Yeah, I mean, at first it sounds ironic that you're going to take your 6 billion base pairs of genome, compress it down to as small as 3 million bytes. So 6 billion base pairs down to 3 million bytes. And then store that into DNA now in a thousandfold compressed form. That could be valuable. I don't think we are quite at the rate now that we're storing petabytes or exabytes, 10 to the 18th bytes of information in DNA the way we are for other media. There are some cases where we are storing that amount of DNA, but we're not writing it with precise digital precision. We're not reading that amount. But anyway, the potential is definitely there. It has long lifetime. It has, it's very cheap to make copies. We can make billions of copies for pennies. It just is challenging to do precise writing and precise reading at scale. But if you want to do imprecise writing, it's still pretty precise, and then only read the parts that you need. For example, a flight recorder in an airplane, you don't read every flight recorder, every flight, every piece of it. You just read the parts that are important for the rare cases where something goes wrong. So I think in that model, we're already ready with DNA, but it's getting better. It's an interesting side market for DNA reading and writing.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, we have to be much better in actually writing DNA and enable those technologies, given that we have really good capabilities in reading the DNA with the sequencing.
Right. It depends on how you're writing. There are ways that you can write directly from the environment into DNA without going through a digital computer. And that is actually much cheaper and much faster than either the electronic means or the reading methods. But then now you could have exabytes of data, but you need a way of selectively reading it because you can't read the whole thing yet. There's selective ways where you can encode where things are in space and time just by where it's stored let's say it's stored in an organism, then where in the organism it's stored is relevant to, the illness, so if you have a kidney illness, it'll be stored in the kidney. And so that greatly reduces the amount of reading you need to do, and the access becomes very intuitive. It's kind of like storage and retrieval. The retrieval, where to go to get a tiny fraction of the data. But this is very far from routine. These are just academic publications from my lab and some others.
What are your thoughts about the need and the utility of the multi-omic approaches? So not just doing the whole genome sequencing, but actually expanding the measurements from the genome to the transcriptome, epigenome, proteome, metabolome. Do you think that this kind of multi-omic approach is actually providing us better ways to understand the biology?
Well, multi-omics is something that's getting a lot of attention, I think, correctly. It's appropriate. It's because the not only is the cost of DNA sequencing come down, but the cost of RNA sequencing and tag sequencing, where you can tag just about anything with a short DNA tag. All of this does improve our ability to make medical decisions, but this is where software does matter. Now, earlier you asked whether software is limiting for whole genome interpretation for, you know, clear, serious Mendelian disease. And I said, no, but here with the multi-omics, there's kind of we haven't quite caught up with the problem is intrinsically more complicated, integrating information about immunology, infectious nucleic acids, the transcript from so many different cells, single cell level resolution of the RNA. These things need to be integrated better and integrated with medical information. But I think that we are severely underdiagnosed considering how cheap it is now and accurate. And so the time has come to apply this incredibly inexpensive diagnosis to a whole variety of medical, environmental, and veterinary uses.
This is maybe also a good time to segue from the kind of multi-omic thinking to think how to actually high-throughput screening can be combined with the multi-omic measurements. And how do you think generally convergence of the multi-omic measurements with the high-throughput screening is going to be enable the new avenues in the drug discovery?
Well, AI machine learning is already making a big impact in novel protein drugs, RNA drugs, and delivery via, say, protein capsids. And it will continue to expand, but those are things where you have solid foothold, and that's because there is so much data. There's hundreds of thousands of examples of every protein category and thousands of protein categories, and this helps us design synthetic protein RNA and viral components that we can then test. And we can test them sometimes in the tens of billions of these at once, all of them designed by AI and then tested and then fed back into the AI algorithm. So that, I think, will be increasingly combined with the multi-omics to do another level of AI machine learning on how to use these powerful drugs in combinations for very common diseases, including the most common of all, which is morbidity and mortality is dependent upon age, the senescence. And so that also will be helped by the multi-omics and the AI machine learning, both for drug design and for deciding what combinations to use.
Maybe it would be greater to dig deeper in some of your startups from your lab, which are using these approaches where they combine the kind of high throughput screening with machine learning and multi-omic readouts. You know, you have mentioned Dino, but it would be great for our audience to talk about the other startups that also came from your lab in that space.
Right. So in the application of machine learning to medicine, I'd say one is standing out. They're all looking good, but one is standing out already, which is designing proteins and nucleic acids. And in fact, out of the 48 startups in my group, at least six of them have a solid leadership position on that, which is Dino Therapeutics for capsids, Shape Therapeutics for capsids and guide RNAs, Jura for immune receptor combinations, T-cell, MHC, Nabla for using antibody design and G protein coupled receptor. Manifold Bio is using designed pairs of proteins so that they can tag hundreds, maybe thousands of proteins in doing clinical trials and preclinical expensive animal trials so that one injection, you can get thousands of results where you can tell which tissues it goes to, the pharmacokinetics and dynamics of of turnover all at once for all these proteins at once. So if you really can get 1,000 protein pharmaceuticals in one experiment, that could be 1,000 times lower costs or higher quality for, say, your expensive non-human primate trials.
So another question that I had for you. So the most recent research from your lab was about the aging. So maybe at a just high level for your audience, can you tell us how are you approaching the studying the diseases of aging in your lab at the moment?
Right. So aging has had a rocky start decades ago, because I think there was kind of a lot of wishful thinking that it would be something simple to eat or not eat, or, exercise or not exercise. And then it transitioned to, we're talking about very powerful medicines here. And that means you have to go through all the complicated randomized clinical trials and so forth. And what's looking particularly promising are gene therapies, because small molecules have provided most of the drugs that we love, but they get confused if you have a complicated network with nearly identical proteins in it, alternate splice forms, multi-gene family members, and so forth. So that's one of the downsides. While when you're using protein, RNA, gene, or cell therapies, you can specify exactly which family member, which splice form you're talking about. And I think gene therapies have, for rare diseases, have built up this stigma of being very expensive. Rightly so, they are expensive. And that was one of the things that worried me, because when I entered the field, because I like the things I work on to be very, very affordable, to be equitably distributed to even the poor people in the poor nations. So what's different is with certain medical applications, they apply to everybody. So, for example, a pandemic is a place where it applies to everybody. So the gene therapy formulations used for vaccines, maybe 5.6 billion people got a gene therapy-like formulation for the COVID vaccines. And the other category is aging, age-related diseases. That's something that affects all 8 billion of us. And so, in principle, the price of the vaccines was $2 to $20. And so, and age-related diseases could be the same or even lower, such that the government or whoever is paying for it will get more return on their investment by avoiding serious health consequences that accompany age, at least putting them off. All that is trillions of dollars. So gene therapies combined with common diseases like age-related diseases looks promising. And within the category of gene therapies, there are two classes. Well, I would say all of the classes are multiple, meaning that there's so many things you need to fix in aging that you're going to need multiple drugs. We use three or more. But then there's two classes, one of which is you have to deliver it to every cell in the body that you want to fix, which is not efficient yet, although it's getting more efficient. And the second category is things that are delivered to an easy tissue like liver, and then it spreads through the blood in protein form throughout the body. And, like some of my companies like Rejuvenate Bio are pursued both of them. Using the Yamanaka factors, which were famous for stem cell prediction, but are now becoming famous again for aging reversal. Rejuvenate Bio has done the first, as far as I know, longevity experiment in an animal preclinical study, and that shows very significant longevity effects. Although getting it through the FDA will probably focus on healthy restoration of health in age-related diseases. So that's one set that has to be delivered to every cell, though. They don't spread. So maybe some of their influence will spread, but the factors themselves, the three Yamanaka factors, don't. Then the other category are some blood-borne ones that are spread by the liver, and that looks very promising as well. So I think that's where I see it, from my point of view, is these multi-gene therapies aimed at the core components of the aging process.
When we think about aging, You know, do we think that there is a, like a single pathway or single like cell type that's the kind of key culprit behind the aging, or it's a more kind of mix of the things? So it's the immune system, it's the DNA repair system, it's the kind of mitochondrial pathways, telomeres, it's maybe number of the viral bacterial infection during their life? Or do you think it's a kind of combination of all these things above that are actually driving the aging?
So my impression, and I think a few other people as well, is that it's all of the above, is that you might have 10 pathways of aging, senescence, cancer, and so forth, that you have to get them all right. If you get one of them right, you might extend lifespan by a year or two. But it's we've gotten to the point where we know a great deal about the pathways that are involved. And so we can finally do all of them at once. Some proteins will affect multiple pathways. And so you might not need 10 proteins to get 10 hallmarks or pathways. Or you could have more proteins than there are pathways. So you get redundant systems, you get, you know, but anyway, it's getting easier and easier to deliver multiple drugs, multiple genes for gene therapy. It's getting easier to assess the impact, the crosstalk between the different pathways. So I think that's where we're going with this. So everything on the wish list is up for grabs all at once. You know, mitochondrial, telomeres, you know, caloric restriction type pathways without the caloric restriction, you know, dealing with senescent cells, either rejuvenating them or eliminating them, et cetera, et cetera. So I think we don't know everything, but we know enough to start engineering. You know, the history of engineering and medical progress has been acting long before we have total information. For example, vaccines, we had almost no knowledge of viruses and immunology, and nevertheless pretty much got the vaccination protocol right in the 1700s. So I think that we're in a really good place now for doing all of the aging pathways simultaneously in one combination therapy.
I would be also very curious to get your perspective on the use of the cell and gene therapies to protect us from the viral infection. Is that a reality? You know, do we think that we can have like a preventive vaccine that can prevent us from all kind of virus infections in life? And how that would actually work?
I would put this in the very challenging category, but we have demonstrated something like that, of protection against viruses for a particular industrial microorganism. We just published it this past year in Nature, where by swapping serine and leucine at a particular transfer RNA in the genetic code, we can essentially, the host cell is fine with it, with the swap, but the virus is broken in every protein of every virus. And we've proven that for a large number of viruses, probably all of them, is the inference. Now, that same trick should work in every microorganism, every plant, every animal, exactly the same approach. It will be harder to do. We're already have begun work on it in animals, especially animals will be donating organs, but it's not available yet. That's every virus, and that doesn't require specific vaccinations. It is essentially kind of a vaccination for all viruses at once. Now, that doesn't protect you against pathogenic bacteria or fungi or cancer, but there may be other out of the box ideas for those. Right. The way it works is that you take the host, let's call it, the organism you care about, which so far is E. coli, but in the future will be, organ donors, and so forth. And you change the genetic code, which is what there's every possible triplet of nucleotides, A, C, G, and T, is encodes the 20 amino acids by 64 triplets. So you have every possible triplet, so that's 4 to the 3 power, 64. If you take two of those triplets, because the tRNA will recognize two at once due to wobble, you take You take one tRNA, a pair of triplets, and that normally encodes serine, and you make it so it encodes leucine now. The host is protected because you've used synonymous codons to get the host not using those dangerous codons. Those codons you're going to remap, you're going to swap. But now the virus is not in on that game. It was not. So therefore, it still has the original code. And the new code, every place there's a serine of this type, it gets switched to a leucine. So in the virus, every protein depends on these serine codons. And now instead of serine, they're leucine, which is a very different chemistry. So it screws up every single protein in a way that so many things are messed up at once in one virus, in each virus, that they can't even evolve around it. That's the way it looks experimentally, and that's the way it looks theoretically as well. We'll need to get more experience both in the industrial microorganism and also in the animals and human cells that we're engineering.
I have a follow-up question. Do you think about starting a company in this space?
We do think that this is valuable industrially. We just published a paper this past year, and so it really hasn't been a chance to talk to me about it. I think the next thing we need to do before it becomes commercialized is to make that strain that is resistant to multiple viruses also be a strain that has multiple industrial features, like high protein production, high metabolite production, and so forth. And so once we have those coupled, then I think it becomes a good startup. Then the next step, the sides of going into mammalian cells, that requires a considerable amount of technology development before we even get the first mammalian cell. And again, it will have to be very robust and have some cutting edge productivity or functionality, medical functionality, in addition to being it's not sufficient for it just to be multivirus resistant. It has to also be high performance in some other category for both the industrial microorganisms and the mammalian species.
And for the end, what are the biggest frontiers or emerging technologies that you are developing in your lab at the moment and that you see in general in bioresearch happening in the next 5 years?
Some examples of some emerging technologies that we're very excited about in my lab, in addition to what we've already talked about, is the ability to synthesize large genomes, mammalian genomes, in one go. Right now, we're struggling to make genomes that are 1,000 times smaller than that, but I think that's going to change overnight. The same way that we went from struggling to sequence single genes to routinely producing millions of whole genomes sequence. So the synthesis of genomes is undergoing a revolution. Our ability to do developmental biology, of being able to make any cell type, of being able to reverse aging and so forth, these are all developmental things, but we're going to get much better at being able to make arbitrary morphologies, being able to make combinations of functionalities, like different protein expression combinations. Building connectomes is another developmental biology where you can direct or enable synapse formation, more orderly brain organoids. We're working on that. Being able to read the multiomics in situ. We mentioned multiomics, but in situ, where you can actually, every pixel, every three-dimensional voxel in a sample, either alive or fixed, we can identify what its name is, DNA, RNA, protein, and possibly metabolite. I think that's undergoing a revolution right now. And all these things interface with one another, where we get hybrid revolutions where you'll get combinations.
Professor Church, it was a great pleasure to talk with you and explore all the frontiers of innovation that you're developing in your lab. Thank you once again.
ARK believes that the information presented is accurate and was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information, and such information may be subject to change without notice from ARK. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this podcast may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions, and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements.